Okay, we're ready to start. I'd like to welcome everybody to session 115, which is Harvest Hills at 35. My name's Devery Anderson. I'm chairing this session. And, of course, want to remind everybody here that we want to make sure our cell phones and pagers and any other noisemakers are turned off. And if at all in doubt, check them right now. So there's always one that goes off and the owner of the phone is the last one to know about it, seems like. So I'm checking mine. It's on vibrate. And we have two gentlemen on the program today. Our presenter is Brian Monty. He's assistant professor of English and Language and Culture at Fontys University of Applied Sciences in the Netherlands. And the respondent is Ron Romig, who is the archivist at the Community of Christ in Independence, Missouri, and also a Harvest Hills resident. And so he's the respondent to this, and so after Ron is done, we should have some time for some questions. This session gets out at 9:45.
Good morning, and welcome to session 115, Harvest Hills at 35. My name is Brian Monty, and this presentation will explore the general history of Harvest Hills, an intentional pilot community which will celebrate the 35th anniversary of its groundbreaking in October 2007. In order to discuss the history of this community, I will concentrate on four areas. First, I will divide Harvest Hills' history into four different periods. Then I will discuss Harvest Hills' philosophy, especially with regards to the concept of Zion, as defined by Joseph Smith Jr. and his son and grandsons. Next, I will describe some short-lived community industries, such as the Harvest Christian School and Cooperative. And last, I will describe the community's contact in its early history with other Mormons. This presentation will take approximately 40 minutes. Please hold your questions and comments until the end. My resources for this presentation include interviews with past and present Harvest Hills residents, the books, readings on concepts of Zion, Zion in Our Time, and Zion in Our Neighborhood, which were both written by Harvest Hills resident Jim Christensen, who passed away, reports from the 1957 and 1967 seminars on Zion, and articles from the Independence Examiner, Kansas City Star, the RLDS COC Saints Herald, and, of course, Harvest Hills' own newsletters. Harvest Hills is a community of approximately 125 people living in 53 housing units just off of Highway 7 in an area of gentle rolling hills in eastern Independence, Missouri. The community is 2 miles north of Blue Springs and 5 miles northeast of the Temple Lot. Officially known as Oak Hill Cluster, these housing units are composed of apartments, townhouses, duplexes, sixplexes, single homes, all grouped around a central commons or green. So you can see that here in the aerial photograph there. Facilities include an outdoor swimming pool, a base basketball tennis court, and a multi-purpose community center which houses a library, a cable television studio, a kitchen, a laundry, and the main hall which holds the church services and community meetings. Harvest Hills was founded by members of the Community of Christ, known until 2001 as the Reorganized Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, RLDS. As of August 1, 2006, Harvest Hills had 122 residents, 47% of whom were members of the Community of Christ. For the convenience of my discussion today, I've chosen to divide Harvest Hills' history into four periods. The first period is one of preparation from 1943 to 1971. Next comes a pioneering phase from 1972 to 1977. After that is a period of robust growth and development from 1978 to 1986. And lastly, a period of limited development and decline from 1987 to the present. Each of these periods has its own unique characteristics and conflicts, which I will define. The preparatory phase for Harvest Hills was the community's longest. It began in 1943 when Wilford Winholtz, one of Harvest Hills' founders and pioneer residents, completed his master's thesis at MIT. His paper was entitled, A Project for a Community Study with a View Towards Integration of Church, Industry, and Society. This phase continued until 1972, the year of the community's groundbreaking. During an interview in May 2006, Winholtz indicated that the idea for his thesis came from the November 1937 radio address by President Frederick M. Smith entitled Church, Industry, and Society. The substance of this address, along with President Frederick M. Smith's ideas about Zion, were later published posthumously in 1951 in Foundations of Zion. In 1958, Pat Elliott, a.k.a. Pat Hetty Winholtz, was a senior at Stanford University. She wrote a thesis entitled A Comparison of the Concept of Zion as Understood by the Puritans and the RLDS Church. According to Winholtz and co-founder Joy Brown, during this preparatory phase, Winholtz and R. Edwin Brown consulted with the reorganized church's presidents and bishops about how to proceed with the building of a Zionic community. In addition, Winholtz and Brown visited President Smith at his Ozark Canyon cabin, to discuss this matter. Winholtz also read Earl T. Higdon's 1940 report for the RLDS First Presidency about the Atherton Stewardship Project, a failed RLDS experimental community which ran for approximately 5 years in the late 1920s and early 1930s. During the 1950s, a group of like-minded RLDS church members met in and around Independence to discuss issues related to the building of a planned community along Zionic principles. Those involved included Wilford Winholtz, now a city planner, Wilmer Andes, a home builder, R. Edwin Brown, a professor of communications and head of the radio station at the University of Kansas, James Christensen, an attorney and certified accountant, and their spouses. During their research into the concept of Zion, this group conducted an exhaustive investigation of the Bible, the Book of Mormon, and the Doctrine and Covenants for passages related to Zion, to use these as a blueprint for their community. The results of this research can be seen in a table in Jim Christensen's 1980 book, Zion in Our Time. The group concentrated especially on revelations in the RLDS COC Doctrine and Covenants. These passages helped define the RLDS concept of Zion as pertaining to five important areas. 1. Zion being the work of the church. 2. Zion as communities having all things in common and no poor. 3. Zion as a place of safety or refuge. 4. Zion as a physical gathering of the saints. And 5. Zion as a spiritual condition. A list of these sections held in common by the RLDS COC Church can be seen on the following slide. Now, I'd like to state that these are some of the sections. So there are many more in the DNC, but the thing that I would like you to concentrate on in this slide is Zion related to one mind, one heart, one mind, no poor, the law of consecration, fleeing to Zion for safety, the creation of the storehouse, the pure in heart, purchasing lands in and around Independence and Jackson County, the United Order being disbanded, and also the change in the financial law at the very end to surplus property or tithing as we know it today as the 10th percent. These passages and many more which I have not mentioned are familiar to students of Zion in both the COC and LDS churches. However, the RLDS church continued to define the concept of Zion through revelations to its church presidents, including Joseph Smith's son, Joseph Smith III, and three of his grandsons, Frederick M., Israel, and W. Wallace Smith, who all later became presidents of the reorganized church. Reflecting his awareness of the past tensions of the saints gathering rapidly into community, and overwhelming and angering their Gentile neighbors, as happened in Kirtland, Independence, Far West, and Nauvoo, Joseph Smith III's references to Zion in his section of the Doctrine and Covenants emphasize a much more gradual settlement in which non-members also participate. COC Section 127, Line 7a, states, quote, "The gathering must not be in haste, nor without due preparation," unquote. In COC Section 128, Line 4a, Joseph Smith III wrote that church members who wanted to move to gathering places must, quote, "consult with the elders and bishops before removing into those regions," unquote. In Line 7a, he reaffirmed that, quote, "the Gentiles shall assist in rebuilding the waste places of Zion," unquote. And in Line 7c, he stressed that the saints, quote, "cannot occupy in any place on the land of Zion which is not under the domination of civil law," unquote. Frederick Madison Smith, Joseph Smith III's son and successor, re-emphasized his father's more gradual, peaceful approach. In COC Section 138, Line 3c, he stated that in order to, quote, "lay securely the foundations for Zion and her buildings, the work should be accomplished in peace and harmony. Unity should prevail," unquote. His brother Israel Smith, who was church president from 1944 to 1956, stated in Section 140, Line 5a, that, quote, "all movements toward Zion and the gathering and the temporalities connected therewith should be done in order," unquote. In Line 5c, he added that, quote, "Zionic conditions are no further away nor any closer than the spiritual condition of my people justifies," unquote. In 1966, W. Wallace Smith, Fred M. and Israel Smith's half-brother, stated in Section 148, Line 9a, that, quote, "the hastening time is at hand when the principles of stewardship accounting and Zionic procedures must be applied more fully than hitherto. This should be done with care to avoid the appearance of a desire by the saints to take what does not rightly belong to them," unquote. Thus, all four of the RLDS presidents stressed the desire for an orderly, slow, peaceful building of Zion, which would not antagonize their neighbors. In 1957, a Zionic seminar was held at Camp Doniphan in Excelsior Springs, Missouri, and in 1967 at the Independent Stone Church. Speakers at these conferences included Ray Zinser, Bishop C. Leslie DeLapp, and RLDS Church evangelist and theologian Arthur Oakman. In January 1962, the Seminar on Zion printed and then reprinted in 1964 a report entitled "Development Program for Rainbow Heights Community Association, Independence, Missouri." This report contained information concerning the religious, economic, social, and physical planning of a Zionic community, including one supplement on the outline of the religious order taken directly from Foundations of Zion. During the 1960s, the future founders of Harvest Hills also visited planned communities in Virginia, Maryland, and Minnesota, and searched for a suitable location for their own community in Jackson County, Missouri. In April 1970, the Seminar on Zion published another report entitled "Planning for a Pilot Community," which was a report about an intentional community based on the findings of the 1967 Seminar on Zion. This report announced that the community would be called Harvest Hills and included a timetable indicating that construction would begin on June 30, 1970. By June 30, 1978, the report predicted the new community would house 4,000 people. On the 21st of June, 1970, 450 RLDS members gathered in the middle of a pasture on a Sunday afternoon to dedicate a plot of ground which would later become the central green of Harvest Hills. Listening to a brass choir play hymns such as "Come, O Thou King of Kings," and "Sing We of the Golden City," they also heard the church's top officers, President W. Wallace Smith, his son and successor, Wallace B. Smith, presiding evangelist Roy Chaville, President of the 12, Clifford Cole, and presiding Bishop Francis Hansen, read passages from the Doctrine and Covenants about Joseph Smith and Joseph Smith III's founding of religious colonies in Independence, Missouri, and Lamoni, Iowa. These were from the inspired version of the Bible or the LDS Book of Moses about Enoch's holy city. The church leaders dedicated the plot of 100 acres among the rolling hills of then unincorporated eastern Jackson County for the building of a Zionic community. In a typewritten address in the COC archives, President W. Wallace Smith, who's pictured here on the slide standing at the podium, wrote that, quote, "It will take a lot of hard work. You will meet with some discouragement from time to time, but you must not lose heart. It is my sincere prayer that your righteous efforts may be crowned with success," unquote. Similar to Joseph Smith III's stance with the Lamona Cooperative, the RLDS Church gave the Harvest Hills Projects its blessing, but only limited indirect financial or administrative support. The church did, however, sell the Rainbow Development Corporation some land for the community, but it did not subsidize the project nor attempt to direct its activities. In September 1970, a spiral-bound prospectus entitled Harvest Hills, a Demonstration Community, referred to by residents as the Brown Book, was published, which, quote, "outlined the community land use, bylaws, and the association operating procedures," unquote. In this prospectus, Harvest Hills founders outlined their plans to build a community of approximately 7,500 residents and 2,300 housing units. 47 units will be built in the initial cluster with a density of about 9 units per acre. The new community would eventually include schools, a university, student dormitories, shopping areas, a community center, and nature walks. Instead of driving around the community in automobiles, residents would trade in their cars at a vehicular exchange storage center on the edge of the community and use electric mini vehicles for intra-community transport. In addition, cooperative industries would be created which would meet the growing community's needs and also provide employment for residents. Another document which is important to Harvest Hills community's philosophy is its covenant. Oh, and by the way, here I've got some of the important points that you're going to see in the covenant or are in the covenant. For example, the covenant acknowledges the people's relationship with God, that they're going to become stewards over what they're given and the resources that they receive, that they will serve all within and without Harvest Hills, that they will mobilize their resources, and that they will create a society of unity, love, and try to abolish poverty. On this slide, you can see when the covenant was written. It was written on the island of Grand Cayman at the Andes Resort there in October 1970. And the principal author of the document was R. Edwin Brown. At Harvest Hills, you have 4 different types of people. You have visitors who come by to see the community, to inquire about it, maybe spend a little bit of time, stay overnight. Then you have people that are considered friends. These might be people who have actually moved into the community, but they have not signed the covenant or really gotten together with the other people that are having the meetings. The seekers are the people who are religiously motivated, who are trying to understand what Harvest Hills is about, and generally they're asked to read the Bible and the Doctrine and Covenants and the Book of Mormon to come to a better understanding of that. And finally, the fourth level, the covenanted member is someone who signs the Harvest Hills Covenant, who promises to dedicate their life towards building an intentional and Zionic community. The coveners sign a scroll and receive full community rights and responsibilities, which includes being able to vote in the Assembly of Stewards. Now, let's get into the next phase of the history. The pioneering phase was from 1972 to 1977. So after all the groundwork was done for all those years from 1943 to 1971, they're finally ready to build their community. On November 1st, 1971, Jackson County, Missouri approved the zoning for the Harvest Hills community, and on the 2nd of October, 1972, ground was broken for the first four units, numbers 9, 10, 11, and 12. These four buildings were occupied in April 1973, and Harvest Hills had its first 17 residents, ranging in age from 3-year-old Leah Stevens to 79-year-old Emma Shaw. Construction on the next four units, units 5, 6, and 7, was begun in 1973, and these and units 1, 2, 3, and 4 were occupied in November 1974. Now, the photo that you got there on the overhead is a photo of units 1, 2, 3, and 4 from 1978, January. In June 1976, Naomi Russell reported in the Herald that the community's population was 49 and that it established a co-op food store, planted berry bushes in vineyards and fruit orchards, organized a mission, and chartered a 4-H club. A building with apartment units, Twin Oaks Apartments, was opened in October 1977. This structure also includes a multi-purpose room on the lower level, which is the community's regular Sunday morning worship space to this day, although the community has repeatedly debated the construction of a new church and or community center building. In addition, people's lives in the new community were interconnected due to the location and construction of the homes. Everyone could see everyone else's front door, and the homes were even connected in their basements via common doors, which Northrop Larson emphasized were a great benefit for the children for play on rainy days. Children were also watched and corrected communally in the beginning. Children had access to other parents' homes until more formal visiting rules were set up. Now, I'd also like to emphasize on this slide the location in the countryside, where children had access to nature for hikes, picnics. They had a 4-H program with a big barn. So this was not a suburban neighborhood. This was still a semi-rural part of Independence. And that's what also made possible the establishment of the community garden. A truly unique feature of this community is its central commons, a green area outside of every resident's front door on which traffic is prohibited. Here, children and adults participate in daily, after-school and weekend games such as baseball, Red Rover, and kick the can, or jumped up and down on the community trampoline. During this period, Harvest Hills experimented with running its own cooperative store, since residents were miles from the closest supermarket in Independence. The co-op was initially started in the mid-1970s as a way for Harvest Hills residents to buy staples or food more cheaply in bulk. Food was originally stored in Unit 4, according to Pioneer resident Alta Stevens, and after that in what is now the library area of the community center after it was built in 1977. The co-op was staffed by volunteers and opened a few hours per week for all residents. In addition, every co-op family had a key so they could take what they needed when they needed it. Recording purchases was on the honor system. Elizabeth Larson said that she and Joanne Boyce went to Odessa, Missouri to buy cheese and ice cream and to Kansas City to buy produce and other food. Larson estimates that the co-op ran for about 5 years and that the Scaifes transferred the concept from Harvest Hills to Independence and began the Independence co-ops. Opinions about why the Harvest Hill co-op failed vary from that of Stevens, who felt that too much money was tied up in the store and that people didn't shop there much, to Winholtz, who felt some person or persons took food without recording their purchases. Northrop Larson mentioned that as the co-op began to decline, the Independence co-op was starting up, and Harvest Hill residents shopped there because it was bigger and had more variety. In Zion in Our Neighborhood, Christensen states that in March 1975, Harvest Hills residents had several meetings with members of the Davis County Cooperative of Bountiful, Utah. He also includes a photo of members from the DCC at a joint meeting of the Harvest Hills Association and the Association of Stewardship Organizations in November 1975. According to Christensen, Harvest Hills residents were interested in this group because even though the DCC only had 150 members, they jointly created various economic enterprises such as coal mines, potato fields, clothing factories, printing houses, and shoe stores. Christensen was further impressed that the group had no outside debts and that DCC members purchased their products from their own stores, not with cash, but with credits earned from their work. Christensen continues that Harvest Hill tried to copy some of the aspects of the DCC's economic model, for example, through trying to institute a joint banking system in 1976. However, Harvest Hill's residents found that the administration of the system, quote, cumbersome and slow, unquote, since it was instituted before the personal computer era. As a result, the community business did not develop as rapidly as been anticipated, so the, quote, joint banking system was discontinued, unquote. During this pioneering period, the most significant conflicts were those related to daily survival, since Harvest Hills had no direct hookup to water and gas lines until 1977. Water for the community was kept in the basement of Unit 12. In addition, there were few concrete walkways. Residents instead walked on wooden boards, many of which were available due to the housing construction. With the arrival of water and gas lines in 1977, Harvest Hills left its pioneer phase and entered a period of robust growth and development. From 1978 to 1987, the community enjoyed its greatest growth and development. The first duplex unit was completed in July 1979. A ring road around the inner cluster of buildings was also constructed at this time. In 1980, Harvest Hill's population, according to Christensen, included 35 families, all members of the RLDS Church. You can see units 190 through 193 under construction there in January 1978 in the top photo. The bottom photo has a map circa 1980 of the community with the ring road. Three terra-domed underground houses were designed and patented by Gale Scape and his Terra-Dome Construction Company, which included energy-efficient construction and rooftop gardens for their houses. Two other dome-shaped units were designed and built by Roy Brown, the son of founders Edwin and Joy Brown. They call those the pumpkin houses, the photo in the bottom there. In addition, in 1983, an outdoor pool was added to the complex, much to the chagrin of the more conservative community members who had hoped that the community would build a new, separate church building instead. According to Winholtz, the supporters of the new church building were outvoted by a large group of adults and children, since each Harvest Hills resident over the age of 8 had the right to vote. So be careful if you give the right to vote to your children in those intentional communities. Also during this period, Harvest Hills experimented with running a school called the Harvest Christian School, which was open from 1978 to 1982. HCS was founded by residents who wanted an alternative Christian education for their children. School instructors attended training classes at Bates City, Missouri Sionita School for the school year 1977-78, and in September 78, the Harvest Christian School opened its doors with Priscilla Carrick as a principal, assisted by three other Harvest Hills residents, Phyllis Christensen, Dorolis Young, and Joanna Boyce. Payment for tuition was either through work in kind for Harvest Hills residents or approximately $45 per month for non-residents. In 1978, the school had 13 students. In 1979, it ran the advertisement that you see here on the overhead, which includes, quote, it's expanding its facilities and will be able to accept more students kindergarten through grade 7, unquote. The Harvest Christian School followed the standard Missouri curriculum with emphasis on practical and vocational skills, but also included prayer at the beginning and end of the school day, instruction in religious topics such as stewardship and restoration heritage, and field trips to historic sites such as Liberty Jail and Hans Mills. Classes were held in Unit 4, but this was deemed unsatisfactory by the Independence Building Inspector. In 1979, a double-wide trailer, now Unit 201, was purchased by School Board President Dale Carrick, who brought it to Harvest Hills. As I mentioned, enrollment increased from 13 in 1978 to 24 in school year 1981 to 1982. The school closed, however, in 1982 when the Carricks left the community that year. During this period, many charitable groups and educational organizations were created. Friends United, a teacher training program in Honduras, was started by Norman and Charlotte Ruoff. The Harvest Christian Foundation, which provides small educational grants to college students, was founded after the dissolution of the Harvest Christian School. New Horizons, an adult educational program of classes, workshops, concerts, and excursions, which was held in the Harvest Hills Community Center during this period, was held in the Harvest Hills Community Center during this period and continued into the mid-90s. Classes in 1986 included The Political Scene, taught by Wilford Winholtz, Indian Beadwork by Mike Nelson, and Potpourri, which included a different subject weekly. The community has also hosted the Seminar on Zion, which is still held at Harvest Hills irregularly, sometimes every 2 years, sometimes every 4 years. It depends on when they decide to have the next meeting. The most significant conflict during this period within the community was caused by the approval of the ordination of women to the priesthood after a revelation to the church through President Wallace B. Smith in 1984. According to one resident, the split in the church over the ordination of women created tension and splits in the community and even among families. After the ordination of women was announced, 7 households or 14 residents eventually left the RLDS church to become restorationists. Among these residents were the Scaife family, who were instrumental in the community with their Terra Dome Construction Company and the Independence Co-op. These families, however, did not move away immediately. One pioneer restoration family remained at Harvest Hills until this year. '87 to the present represents a period of increasing resident individuality and heterogeneity, a sharp decrease in construction and land available for the community's further development. Compared to the building boom from 1978 to 1986, only 2 structures were built between 1987 and 2007, one housing unit and one community storage barn. According to Christensen, the lack of new construction was due to a recession in the Missouri economy in the mid-1980s, coupled with rising interest rates. Quote, there were no requests for lots and few applications for new memberships, unquote. In addition, several notes from the Rainbow Development Corporation investors came due during this period. In order to pay them off, in 1993, Rainbow sold 265 acres of land back to the RLDS Church. This sale left the community debt-free, but with no land to create a second housing cluster as originally envisioned in the 1970 master plan. Perhaps as a reflection of the growing diversity in the community, a resident reported during her community that during the mid to late 1980s, many owners began to paint the exteriors of their units different colors. So you remember that first unit I showed you from 78, all plain brown wood shingles? Well, take a look at the second slide there down from the top. The first one's there again. That's the second one to compare. Now people are painting their units in different colors. They're adding ornamentation on the front and the back of them, little porches, decks in the back, things like that. The new diversity in the community also included an influx of some of the first non-RLDS families. For example, in the late 1980s, the Hams and the Peacocks, who were Catholic and LDS respectively, moved into Harvest Hills. At first, both families were rather apprehensive about the RLDS church and community residents. The Catholic family, according to Jim Christensen, was warned about, quote, secret rites and brainwashing, unquote. Both families, however, after getting to know their neighbors at Harvest Hills, decided eventually to be baptized into the RLDS church in the summer of 1991. More recent COC residents, however, do not seem to be aware of or as interested in Harvest Hill's religious ideals. From August 2006 to February 2007, a questionnaire was circulated among Harvest Hill's residents to measure their demographics, psychographics, and opinions of and wishes for their community. Of the 19 residents who lived at Harvest Hills for 5 years or less, 12 or 63.16% stated that they had moved to Harvest Hills for non-religious reasons. 5 moved to Harvest Hills for economic reasons, another 5 for social reasons, and 2 for geographic reasons. 1 respondent did not answer the question. Of the 6 respondents, or 31.58%, who moved to Harvest Hills for religious reasons in the last 5 years, 2 were COC, 2 were restorationists, and the remaining 2 included 1 non-denominational respondent and 1 respondent who did not indicate his religion. This questionnaire sample correlates with the community census by religion, which is available from the period 1999 to 2006. Now, these are precise data points that you see here on the graph from 99 to 2006. The others before that are also precise, and the line in between is interpolated. During this time, Harvest Hills non-COC population almost doubled from 27% to 53%. So now the COC residents are in the minority. At this point, a thorough investigation has not been done into the reasons for the possible declining COC interest in living in Harvest Hills. According to one returnee resident, however, many founders and pioneers' children may have wanted to stay once they reached adulthood in the 80s and 90s, but could not due to the lack of new or available housing units. She mentioned that unlike in 2007, during the 80s and 90s, Harvest Hills units were rarely put on the market, maybe 1 every 5 years. And as Christensen has mentioned, no new units were built during this period. From 1998 to 2001 especially, Harvest Hills' social cohesiveness seems to have been tested according to reports of crime, antisocial behavior, and a decreasing level of volunteerism in the community's newsletter, Happenings. Crimes reported during this period included thefts from automobiles, mailboxes, homes, and storage barns, the vandalism of community property, disorderly conduct, and sexual abuse. Happenings also reported in its July 6, 2000 edition, discussion about the enforcement of community rules about smoking and alcohol consumption in public, which was repeated in its October 4, 2001 issue. Complaints about motorists speeding around the one-way ring road or driving in the wrong direction were also listed in the newsletter, as well as complaints about unlicensed cars parked in the parking lot, which the community threatened to tow away. The feeling of safety in the community seems to have hit a low point in August 2001, when Happenings mentioned that someone made a suggestion there that school buses pick up and drop off children in front of their own units rather than at the Red Schoolhouse along Highway 7. That's where the students wait to go up to school, which was vandalized in 1998 and 2000. Another suggestion was that the community buy a metallic magnetic sign with the wording Harvest Hills Security, which would be affixed to a car that would drive around the community. In addition, in its August 9, 2001 issue, Happenings included an article about requiring landlords to do a background and credit check for new renters. Harvest Hills' response to these crimes and antisocial behavior committed by outsiders and some of its own residents was to organize, educate, and increase community outreach. In 1999, an after-school snack and activities program was initiated for children, and locking mailboxes were installed. SOARS, or the Stewards Orientation Recommendation classes, were held for new residents to explain Harvest Hills' history and philosophy, and over 70 residents attended a covenant signing ceremony on the 23rd of March 2000. Outdoor lighting was improved, a special lighted secure parking area was created, and residents met with the Independence Police for special workshops on how to set up a neighborhood watch. In addition, Harvest Hills joined the Eastern Jackson County Landowners Association so it could use its facilities to screen prospective tenants and homeowners. A new organization, Oak Hill Properties, was also created to buy units which went on the market. This seems to have helped because as of 2002, the major infractions listed in the Happenings concerned dog owners not cleaning up after their pets, rubbish near dumpsters, and improperly parked vehicles, so the everyday sort of thing that you complain about in the community. Another problem during this period was declining volunteerism. In its August 30, 2000 issue, Happenings mentioned that there were 150 jobs which needed to be done, and this was reiterated also the following year in August 2001. One of the casualties of this lack of volunteers was the community newsletter, which was published weekly from the 1980s to December 2005. In January 2006, the newsletter became a monthly and then ceased publication in October that year. At present, Harvest Hills has no community newsletter. Finally, another unresolved issue is whether Harvest Hills will build a new community center and or senior center. Since the building of the pool in 1983, this topic has been routinely explored by fact-finding committees and debated by residents, but at present the issue is stalemated. Whether the community center is ever built, however, will probably be determined by the COC residents, who supported 83.9%, and whether they can convince their non-COC neighbors, who oppose it 62.5%, to change their minds. All 21 past and present residents who were interviewed in depth stated that they felt that the best feature of Harvest Hills was that it was a good place to raise their children, and that because of the community's layout around a central green, they all knew their neighbors very well. The average overall satisfaction rate of all the 53 questionnaire respondents on a scale of 1 to 5, 1 being very poor and 5 being very good, was a 3.83. At the end of May 2007, the COC Church announced plans to build 5,000 to 13,000 homes on land that it owns near Harvest Hills. Whether the proximity of more homes or stores will renew interest in Harvest Hills has yet to be seen. Conclusion. Harvest Hills history can be divided into the four different stages I've explained. Preparation, pioneering, robust growth and development, and limited growth and decline. Each period has produced new insights, endeavors, and conflicts related to creating and maintaining an intentional Zionic community. During its 3.5 decades, Harvest Hills has weathered significant physical, financial, theological, and social conflicts which have threatened the continuity of the community experiment. As Harvest Hills prepares to enter its 35th year, it is debt-free. The overall satisfaction rate of the 53 residents was a 3.83. All interviewees stated that their community was, in general, a good place to grow up and raise children. Harvest Hills attempts to produce a stable economic base through community industries, such as a cooperative store or a school, however, have failed so far. In addition, the community has also retained a fraction of its children, perhaps due to the lack of new housing. Finally, Harvest Hills has been stalemated on the building of a new community center and senior wing, and its growth as a planned community has fallen far short of the founders' original projections of thousands of homes. As mentioned during the interviews, as can be shown in the recently distributed questionnaire, the original religious ethos of the community seems to be fading as more COC and non-COC new residents move to Harvest Hills for economic, geographic, and social reasons. In 1997, Jim Christensen predicted that, quote, the problems of people voluntarily leaving the community were similar. They could sell to persons who had no sympathy with the neighborhood goals. This would have the same effect of nullifying the project if very many people sold at the same time, unquote. Whether the new minority status of the COC residents might jeopardize the community's original religious purpose or permanently block the construction of a new community center or seniors wing are two of the subjects I would like to explore in more depth in my next paper. That will be given at the John Whitmer Historical Association Conference in Kirtland, Ohio on September 29, 2007. Thank you for your time and attention. Now, Ron Romig, Harvest Hills resident and COC archivist, will respond to my presentation, after which we will open the session for questions.
Though generally satisfied with the experience of living in Harvest Hills, there have been several noteworthy disappointments. Foremost has been the significant decline of interest in Zionic endeavors within the membership of the Community of Christ. During the life of the community, the institutional church has consistently de-emphasized Zion. Second, Harvest Hills has not succeeded in generating an adequate economic basis to support a comprehensive trial of Zionic theory. For example, we have no community businesses at present. Participants are forced to seek employment outside of the community. I believe we could knit a stronger community fabric if a substantial portion of the association derived its living from community-related work. Third, the community has little control over the transfer of privately held properties. Committed members die or move, leaving the properties to others with less interest in community. People now come to Harvest Hills for widely differing reasons. It is critical that we begin to replenish the community with invested participants. Fourth, our inability to retain community youth has made it hard to perpetuate community values. Having been remarkably stable for its first 30 years, Harvest Hills is now in rapid transition. This is what Brian describes as phase 4, limited growth and decline. Brian mentioned the disruptive effect on the community caused by RLDS Church's institution of women's ordination in 1986. The passing of founders or first-generation members is another important factor negatively impacting community life at this point. With Community of Christ residents now in the minority, we are experiencing a sense of old-time residents versus new residents. For example, long-termers have believed that a community center was necessary in order to facilitate shared community experiences, while new residents appear to believe that other community infrastructure needs are more pressing. All of these factors tend to complicate effective internal communication and negatively impact community volunteerism. Society is currently experiencing a resurgence of interest in alternative community. Co-housing initiatives are emerging around the country, and there is a growing social consciousness of the importance of lifestyle simplification. Harvest Hills has enjoyed such a quality of life for over 30 years, but we seem strangely out of phase with the experience of the majority of Community of Christ folks. Community of Christ planners are presently rolling out a more upscale, sophisticated version of Zionic community. Community of Christ is inaugurating a new planned community on 17,000 acres in eastern Jackson County, Missouri, called Harmony Residential Community. Maybe this is what CSCers will want. Some of this neighborhood will be immediately adjacent to Harvest Hills. It remains to be seen whether Harvest Hills will be benefited or negatively impacted by this initiative. With forethought, Harvest Hills could be well positioned to take advantage of anticipated area growth. Rather than positioning ourselves to capitalize on such new opportunities, Harvest Hills seems to be slowly winding down. Presently, many residents are non-responsive to internal issues requiring group participation and decision-making. For example, when Brian presented the preliminary version of this paper to community residents last week, only those with Community of Christ connections turned out to hear. On the whole, Harvest Hills has been a remarkable place of acceptance and tolerance. It has been a satisfying setting in which to live. Brian recognizes it as an interesting sociological experiment. I'm glad Brian is taking time to examine it in more detail, and I'm wondering if we can use his findings to revitalize Harvest Hills.
All right. Thank you both for the presentations. We have about 10 minutes left for any questions you might have. Please use the aisle microphone that's been set up there. It makes for a much nicer tape to listen to hear your questions directly.
Who owns the library in Independence, Missouri, that used to be the Community of Christ Library? And how many divisions have been since 1986 in the Community of Christ?
Well, the word of our demise is somewhat early, I guess, because the library archives has been part of Harvest Hill, or part of the Community of Christ at Independence, is still in existence and still thriving and still serving the larger scholarly community. Through the years, we've, taken a great deal of pleasure in encouraging good scholarship and providing access to information that sometimes is not easily accessible. So in terms of your question about the library, it's still thriving and still serving its purposes. Will you just remind me of the other dimension of your question? The question is about how many divisions that have resulted since women's ordination in the RLDS, now Community of Christ, religious tradition. And the reality is there's no way to know. As Brian mentioned, the initial reaction was that a number of people who had been active in the RLDS Church withdrew and formed independent branches. They claimed to continue to be RLDS members, but just were not responsive to the leadership of the church, nor did they feel obligated to conform to conference decisions, such as ratifying the ordination of women. Yeah, there are... Yeah, the reality is that the Independence Branch strategy, I think, has not been terribly successful. They've had internal divisions. A number of people have left the Independent Branch kind of strategy and formed independent churches, just organized as churches. And so there may be 40 or 50 of those independent churches in addition to the 200 independent branches that Bill has talked about. Recently, Community of Christ and the Restoration branches have been holding some discussions, and we're hoping that there can be more tolerance and more understanding, less more of the sense of just responding to rumors that circulate in both communities.
Could you describe in a little more detail the governance structure of Harvest Hills? Obviously, it's participatory and voting, but are there officers that are elected? When someone has an issue, who do they take it to? How do you mobilize support for it? And if there's, this may be a separate question, but since religion seems to have driven a lot of the idealism that would lead people to be involved in an intentional community, to what extent can you continue to draw on the religious idealism of those present when there's not a shared basis except perhaps general Christianity?
Brian asked me to respond to the governmental structure. The Harvest Hills is set up as basically kind of similar to what you might call a homeowners association, and each participant has voice and vote in decisions that affect the community. It's a little bit like homeowner association in the sense that individuals own their own property, their own home, but there are many community facilities that are owned in common. And so those meetings, there are two regularly scheduled meetings every year. One is a budget meeting, one is to elect officers. But then as needed, we call other meetings. Then out of that is the basis, really the legal basis, is a not-for-profit corporation of the state of Missouri. There is a board of directors. And so ultimately, Assembly of Stewards advises the Board of Directors. The Board of Directors tries to be real sensitive to those, but ultimately the legal responsibility to make management decisions rests with the Board. I am a member of the Board.
Lavina, could you please repeat the theological part of your question that you had before? Do you remember that? No.
It was a tactical question, since it seems that religious idealism would be one of the main motivations for entrance into and continued participation in an intentional community. To what is your idealistic base, or do you have one, besides maybe general Christianity, for revitalizing the commitment to the community?
Now, do you mean my ideological base or the community's ideological base?
The community's.
Okay.
As a scholar, what do you observe as the options?
Okay. Well, that's an interesting question. Well, there are a lot of founders who are leaving the community at this point, older residents, because they need to go into assisted care. So what could possibly happen to revitalize the theological base is maybe do some advertisements at Grayson University, for example, for students graduating there, offer them help with buying homes in Harvest Hills. There's a bit of cash there at Harvest Hills now that everybody's in their 70s and 80s, so they're not struggling as much as before. So they could sponsor new families, new students, the cooperative housing that Ron mentioned, many COC students, when they're finished at Graceland, some of them come back to the Independence area, so it might be a new base for them to start out, and they could bring their enthusiasm and their religious zeal with them to continue the community. Is that sufficient? Or would you like more description? Or? Good question. Okay, there's two theories about how to build a Zionic community. It's either inclusive or exclusive. So inclusive means you bring everyone in who's interested in pulling together, working together, living in community, whether they're COC, Restorationist, a Methodist, Baptist, as long as they're interested in working together in community to solve problems. The other format is exclusive, only bringing COC people in. So both systems can be successful. You have more commitment mechanisms when you're exclusive and you only have COC people than you do when you're inclusive. And Morris Draper has a saying about the leaven in the community. The new RLDS COC concept is you go out into the world to build Zion. You plant it in different places. You start with the seed, and that's how it develops. Okay.
Keep it short, probably, because are we running out of time? Okay. My name is Robert Poort. I'm a citizen of the Netherlands living in the United States. And
Goedemorgen.
I'm sorry.
Goedje van Dr. Zien, yeah.
Fellow Dutchman there almost. And I'm a member of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And just a little bit of history. The very first saints who went to Zion from the Netherlands, I'm talking about 1860, were Christian, what they called Christian anarchists. They were extremely poor. They felt totally ousted by the rest of society and felt they should build intentional communities. I'm not sure how it actually played out once they got to the Great Salt Lake. But so I'm very interested in, my wife is Polynesian, who put a great emphasis on community because of their culture. And together with my church membership, you know, Nauvoo, United Orders, this I find a really thrilling concept. And my one question is, what was the one thing, if there was one thing, strategic error or turning point, what caused somewhat of the decline of Harvest Hill? Is there one thing that should have been different?
In my opinion, there is. There should have been more houses built in the 80s and 90s when people were coming of age and wanting to start their own households there. But unfortunately, due to the recession in Missouri at that time and the debt that the community was holding. They had bought too much land. They had thought that they were going to expand to be a much larger community. If they'd been a little bit more conservative in the amount of land that they bought and had less debt and made new houses for their children to move into once they came of age, I think that would have helped.
This is just kind of a trivia question. In the summer of 58, while I was in college, I spent the summer in Independence, and I went to meetings of a group called the Purple Circle, and it included Winholtz and Brown, Christensen, Naomi Russell, Wilmer Andes, and others who ended up at Harvard Hills. I assume they're part of this development process in that part one of your paper. And have you ever heard of the Purple Circle? And I'm particularly curious if you know what this Purple Circle meant.
Yes, I have. I've talked with residents about it a bit, and also Barbara and Dick Howard. Mm-hmm. Some members of the Purple Circle were involved in setting up Harvest Hills, but they weren't the same. Mm-hmm. People in the Purple Circle were not necessarily involved in the founding of Harvest Hills, all of them. But they did take some members from that group to become the core for this new community. Mm-hmm.
But you don't know what the Purple Circle name meant, do you?
No. That I'm going to have to find out through further research.
Oh, okay. Just one final quick question, too. Do those Doctrine and Covenants sections, Fred M. and so forth, refer to, you know, one heart and mind and peace and harmony and so forth? Is it when the leaders of the church say that, you know, we're going to do it in harmony and one thought in mind, doesn't that tend to stifle dissent? In other words, in order to have everybody one heart and mind, then follow the leader?
Well, actually, you're asking me to comment theologically on the Doctrine and Covenants, and I don't really feel that I'm qualified to handle that question. I am qualified to talk about Harvest Hills and how the sections in the DNC motivated them to put their community together, but I don't really think I should comment further. Not really. I think the church has changed a bit, and Harvest Hills has stayed with the church's philosophy in the 1960s, 1970s. However, there are points of similarity. They are both interested in building community, communities of hope, and what are the other three things that we mentioned? Pardon? Peace. Joy, hope, love, and peace. So that's our new motto that we've had since, I believe, 2001 or so. And it's in the name of the church also, Community of Christ now.
All right, that wraps it up. Thank you all. Thanks to the presenters, and thanks for your comments. That's the end of this session. Thanks.